Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager. Welcome to the Heretics Hour on this Monday, August 17th, 2015. It's been a while since I've done a Heretics Hour program, but this one is very much needed because 100 years ago today, on August 17th, 1915, at 7 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts, Leo M. Frank paid with his life for the murder of 13-year-old little Mary Fagan. It was unusual, though, in the fact that instead of being hanged by the state of Georgia, as was called for by the jury verdict of guilty brought against Frank, he was lynched by a committee of 28 well-known, responsible male citizens of Cobb County, Georgia. Therein lies a large part of the reason for the continuing unease with this event, even 100 years later. The main interest comes from Jews, but not all Jews see profit in what the more activist Jews are doing with it today. Activist Jews being those who run the Anti-Defamation League, the B'nai B'rith International, the American Jewish Committee, the Jewish World Congress, the Jewish Federation of Greater Atlanta, Emory University Institute for Jewish Studies, and on and on. On the other side, interest comes from people like us, you and me, who care about this event that took place 100 years ago because these activist Jews are trying to wipe Leo Frank's very real guilt off the face of history. That is the real objective and is what this program will be about. In pursuit of this objective, in 1983, the Anti-Defamation League spearheaded a petition for a posthumous pardon for Leo Frank, based on what they called new evidence. This new evidence came from the former office boy at the pencil company, who had only worked there for 3 weeks at the time, and it came 69 years later. In 1913, the boy, Alonzo Mann, was 14 years old. In 1982, he announced that he wanted to clear his conscience before he died by clearing the name of Leo Frank. Of course, like with some Holocaust witnesses, the principals involved in his story are no longer around to verify or counter his claims. The story he told went like this. The boy worked that holiday morning in Frank's office, but left at 11:30 a.m., with Frank's permission, in order to meet his mother downtown to watch the Memorial Day parade with her. When his mother didn't show up, he eventually got bored and went back to the pencil factory. When he walked in the front door, he saw the Negro janitor, Jim Conley, holding a limp female body against his chest, standing near the scuttle hole to the basement. Jim pointed a finger at him and said, "If you ever tell anybody, I'll kill you." Alonzo, frightened, ran back out the front door, took the streetcar straight home, and told his mother what had happened. She told him never to mention it, to stay out of it. It was none of his business. When his father came home, he concurred. And so, through all of the next 2 years of trials and appeals, and all of the many years after that, Alonzo remained silent about seeing Jim Conley. I find his story hard to believe. In fact, I don't believe it, because it doesn't fit the evidence. But Alonzo Mann passed 2 lie detector tests. Even so, the Pardon and Parole Board rejected the petition because it did not prove the innocence of Frank. They never will be able to, and they know it, because in 1986 the Jews tried again, this time asking for a pardon that didn't address guilt or innocence, but only the fact of the state's culpability in Frank's death for failing to protect him from being abducted from the prison he was in and lynched. This was granted, and the ADL and other Jewish groups appeared satisfied with it, since they don't believe they can get anything better. But now, on this 100th anniversary, there is an Atlanta rabbi who has been lobbying for several years to have Frank exonerated of all guilt in the murder of Mary Fagan. For Rabbi Steve Lebo, or Lebo, who came to Atlanta in 1986, which is the year of the last pardon application, as a matter of fact, rather coincidentally, from Fort Lauderdale. He came from Fort Lauderdale. He has been very involved with having historical markers made to keep alive the memory of the Leo Frank trial and lynching. And he led a memorial to Leo Frank in his synagogue yesterday. And another was held in the second Atlanta synagogue. He makes sure he gets at least one non-Jew as a featured speaker for these affairs, otherwise it's mostly all Jews. On this occasion, he had the former Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court, Justice Norman Fletcher, on board to speak, but also immigration lawyer Dale Schwartz and Van Perlberg, another Jewish Georgia politician who talks up the case. I'll tell you a story about this Dale Schwartz, as he told it to an interviewer. He was 11 years old, this would have been in 1953, when his parents took over a department store in a small North Georgia town where they became the only Jewish family. When his parents hired a black couple, a group of white women confronted his mother. His mother said to these white women, "Wait, they raise your children and give them milk from their breasts, and they can't sell you a dress?" his mother said. "They stormed out," Schwartz says, chuckling at the memory. Well, from the phrase, "sell you a dress," it indicates that this black couple was hired as salespeople. And I can tell you that in 1953, there were no Negro salespeople, even in my hometown in Illinois. And you would never have found a Negro as a salesperson in a store. So it was a pretty audacious thing that Dale Schwartz's parents did in going to this little Georgia town, buying the only department store, and then integrating it. And I suppose the people, now what the people there should have done, of course, is to not go to that store and not buy anything from that store anymore. But you know how it goes. People do what is most convenient for them in the end. And if that was the only decent store in town that had the things that they wanted, and they otherwise would have to drive to another town to get what they needed, and maybe wouldn't have been as good a selection as they had in their department store, they will eventually go ahead and go. They'll do what is most convenient for themselves. And this is where we make our mistake. The Jews get their white Christian helpers by getting them to believe in anti-Semitism and being guilty of injustice. For white people, and not just Christians, forgiveness comes easily. Naturally, it feels better to say, let's be kind, let's let bygones be bygones, and this is why Jewish activists eventually get their way. But this Dale Schwartz and Rabbi Lebo and Van Perlman, he's another Jewish lawyer politician in Atlanta, are crusading for further forgiveness for Leo Frank and reevaluation, and that is why it is of concern to us. One reason is that Frank is not the first or the only Jew for whom Jewish media and money power has been used to make the public believe in his innocence. Captain Alfred Dreyfus comes to mind. And the Russian Jew Menachem Bilas, who was accused in 1911 of ritual murder of a local boy. I will look at these two a little further on in the program. And of course they are always portrayed as victims of anti-Semitism. This has been used since time immemorial. It is not new or modern. It is ancient to blame the other for hatred and prejudice against the Jew because he is a Jew, not because the other has a real, genuine, legitimate grievance. I don't need to tell my listeners that. You all know it. I want to say now that Leo Frank was and is guilty. There is no doubt about it. The evidence shows it, even without the testimony of Jim Conley. Why am I so sure? I started reading about it and found myself going to the next thing and the next thing, as has happened to other people. There truly are some wonderful folks involved, admirable Southern people. Hugh Dorsey, the prosecutor, is one. Another is the brilliant Tom Watson, journalist and lawyer who was first approached with $5,000 to take up the defense of Frank, but declined, much to his credit, $5,000 in 1913 money. He wrote about the trial in his monthly magazine, The Jeffersonian. The whole spirit of the times and of the people are interesting to me. After reading generally about the trial, I settled down to read Mary Fagan Keene's book, The Murder of Little Mary Fagan, which I found interesting from start to finish. She is Little Fagan's great niece. I then read the entire closing argument of Hugh Dorsey, the prosecutor, which took 3 days in court to complete. After that, I read 5 of the quite long installments about the trial by Tom Watson in his monthly magazine. These were really remarkable writing by a very gifted and good man. I was spellbound by them. Then, along with some other things, I made sure to read the closing arguments of Frank's lead attorneys, Luther Z. Rosser and Reuben R. Arnold, neither of which are Jews. In my opinion, their arguments are based entirely on trying to create doubt in the minds of the jurors by dismissing or belittling the evidence and the prosecution witnesses. They presented no credible theories for how the girl died, except that Jim Connolly was stupid enough to grab her purse as she came down the stairs from Frank's office, where Frank, his boss, was sitting and could hear sounds from downstairs. You realize sound rises. And also realize that Connolly had been employed there for 2 years and had never done anything like that before. Whereas it was established that Frank had a reputation with some of showing too much interest in the girls working for him. Now I want to very briefly go through the course of events from arrest to lynching in my own words. In 1915 in Cobb County, Georgia, the people did what was needed to be done when the authorities failed to serve the interests of the people. The people's institutions, the courts of the judicial branch of their government, had found 29-year-old Leo M. Frank guilty of the murder of 13-year-old Mary Fagan and deserving of being hanged. As he had wrapped a cord around little Mary's neck while she was unconscious and pulled it tight until her life was snuffed out, so the same would now be done to him. The community out of which Mary Fagan had come were satisfied. They had followed the evidence presented at the trial carefully and believed that Frank was justly convicted. But a man, the governor of the state, intervened. He had the ability to commute a sentence of death to life imprisonment, and he used it at the behest of the powerful friends and legal team of Leo Frank. This action by the governor was felt by the people as a shock, a betrayal, and a denial of justice. It had been 2 years since the murder, and the case had been appealed through the courts of Georgia to its Supreme Court, and then even to the nation's highest court, the United States Supreme Court. No legal case could go beyond that. And in every review by a higher court, with Frank's expensive lawyers, the best money could buy, arguing with all the skill and energy they possessed, the original trial record in Atlanta, Georgia, was sustained. No fault, no lapse, no prejudice, no outside interference, no anti-Semitism was found by these impartial higher judges. The verdict stood all tests. Thus, the only option left was to convince the governor to commute the sentence to life imprisonment, giving opportunity for the Frank supporters to continue to seek ways to undo the verdict of the people of Fulton County, Georgia. In the other two cases I mentioned, Dreyfus and Bylus, the Jews achieved their goal of total innocence being declared, with the cause of the accusations against them attributed to anti-Semitism. In the Frank case, this has not yet happened. They have come a long way with the public consciousness, that is, people saying they believe Frank is innocent. But based on what? Newspaper endorsements of his innocence, but not with legal documents. The trial was fair and did not leave all the loose threads the Jews would have you believe. Most of the people in Marietta still say Frank was guilty. I want to go through some facts about the trial testimony that made an impression on me. This is not a comprehensive account at all, but just what struck me in my reading. First, Leo Frank was the last person to see Mary Fagan alive. They always say that you need to be suspicious of the last person to see someone alive, and for good reason. Mary Fagan came to him between 12 and 12:15 for her pay on Saturday, April 26, a state holiday. That means that all the people in the plant, they had the day off, although I don't think they got paid. In any case, Jim Connolly was sitting under the stairs on a holiday because of a special request from Frank to watch who came and left by the front door. Another woman saw him sitting there when she entered, so there was confirmation of his presence there on that day. No one ever saw Mary Fagan alive again after she entered that building a little after 12 noon. The murder occurred around that time, according to the blood and hair and stomach contents evidence, in the back area of the second floor. Frank was the only other person on the second floor, except for 14-year-old Montine Stover, who came up to the office and stayed for 5 minutes. Frank lied about knowing Mary Fagan when asked about her by police on Sunday morning, saying that he didn't recognize her name. But witnesses testified during the trial to seeing him speaking to her and calling her Mary. She also worked on the second floor on the way to the bathroom that Frank used. He passed her regularly, and she had worked there for a year. Frank changed his story twice about the time Mary Fagan came into his office to get her pay. He first said she arrived at 12:03. The next day, in a formal statement to police, he said it was between 12:05 and 12:10. A week later, Montine Stover's mother revealed that her daughter was in his office during that exact time, and he was not there. Montine Stover had also come to pick up her pay. Frank had insisted he was in his office the whole time between 12 noon and 12:30 on that day. At the inquest, Frank had said he thought Mary arrived between 12:10 and 12:15, and he said this because of Stover's testimony. When Frank made his long statement to the jury, he said he may have unconsciously gone to the bathroom without remembering it to account for the time that Montine Stover was in the office looking for him. But of course, he then put himself back in the bathroom area in the metal room where the murder took place. And at the time it took place. None of this is ever brought up by the Frank is innocent crowd, who say he was convicted on Jim Connolly's evidence alone. The hair on machinist R.H. Barrett's machine was Mary's, according to everyone who worked on that floor. The defense disputed it, so the body was exhumed and hair removed from her corpse and given to Dr. Harris to compare the two. This is what Dr. Harris said. The two specimens of hair were so much alike that it was impossible for me to form any definite and absolute opinion as to whether they were from the head of the same person or not. What a statement. What was he afraid of? Or who? No one came forth to say they knew how the blood spots came to be in the same area where the hair was. That they were not there on Friday at closing, everyone was sure of, and were first seen on Monday morning. What I'm saying there is that there were no other suggestions for where the blood came from if it didn't belong to Mary Fagan. The time card of the night watchman Newt Lee was tampered with by Frank. On Sunday, Frank showed it to detectives as being correctly punched every half hour. But on Monday, he said he had made a mistake, and it was missing 3 punches. He produced it. Frank had decided to try to frame Lee for the murder. He also suggested to the detectives that they go and check out Newt Lee's laundry and check around in his home, as Frank offered to show his own laundry to the police to show if there was any bloody clothing stuffed in there, which there wasn't. But it turned out that a shirt with blood on it was planted at the bottom of Newt Lee's laundry barrel, and Newt Lee was arrested and held for quite a long time, but eventually the truth about it came out, and it was shown that all of this was planted, which didn't look good for the defense either. The defense claims that Connolly threw Mary Fagan down the scuttle hole from the first floor on his own while Connolly claimed he and Frank took her dead body down in the elevator from the second floor. Sergeant Dobbs of the police swore that the trail of the body dragged over the floor in the basement led back to the elevator. His exact words were, "It began immediately in front of the elevator at the bottom of the shaft." And this, of course, supported Connolly's story. Frank's rich relative hastened to hire lawyers for Frank before he had been accused of a crime. They wanted to make sure Frank didn't screw up in talking to the police. They knew he could be guilty and wanted to make sure he did not talk. Also wanted to make sure, probably, that he was not found guilty, even if he was. Frank made a long statement to the jury, but did not allow himself to be cross-examined. He answered no questions from anyone. And of course, I ask, is this the behavior of a man who believes himself innocent? Neither Frank nor his lawyers questioned, that is, cross-examined, the girls who accused him of bad or less vicious behavior at the pencil factory. Now, why did they not do that? Because they were afraid that it would bring out more details about what Frank said and did. Rosser, Frank's lead attorney, took the then governor-elect Slayton into his law firm in May 1913, right after Mary Fagan was killed, Frank was arrested, and Rosser became Frank's lead attorney. To fully comprehend the infamous betrayal of the state of Georgia by Governor Slayton, you must keep in your mind the astounding fact that he joined Rosser's firm after that firm had been employed to defend Frank and had publicly taken part in his case. A governor cannot practice law openly, in Georgia anyway, and in June 1913, John M. Slayton was to be inaugurated for a term of 2 years. He was at this time governor-elect. Why, then, did he in May join a firm with which he could not openly act until after June 1915? And why did Rosser, in May 1913, take in a partner whom he could not openly use during the next 2 years? These are questions that were asked by Thomas Watson, and they're very good questions. Frank's wife refused to go see him for 3 weeks after he was held in the tower. They say he didn't want to put her through such a visit, but if he really loved her, and she him, they would have needed to see each other. Theirs was a cold marriage of convenience, which gives credibility to Frank's kinky lust for young girls and prostitutes. She also refused to be buried next to him. She was cremated and asked that her ashes be scattered in an Atlanta park in order to avoid the problem of burial. Governor Slayton falsely stated and repeated over and over that Judge Roan, who oversaw the Frank trial, requested a commutation of Frank's sentence from Slayton. Judge Roan continued to say, notably to his pastor and his daughter, that the evidence unquestionably demonstrated Frank's guilt. And not until Judge Roan had been dead more than 2 months, he died not too long after the end of the trial. There was a forged letter presented, which stultified Judge Roan's account and contradicted his judicial declarations of record in the case. Frank was convicted on the testimony of a Negro, it is said. All the newspapers repeated that, and all the magazines, too. But it is not true, especially because Connolly was Frank's accomplice by his own admission, and the law does not admit anyone to be convicted upon the testimony of their accomplice. But also because there was enough evidence to convict Frank without the testimony of Jim Connolly. It was also said in all the newspapers and magazines all around the country that Judge Roan allowed the audience in the courtroom to intimidate the jury by shouting their threats to the jury while the trial was in progress. This is patently false. If this had been so, Frank's lawyers would have been able to move for a mistrial and gotten it. This is an example of how the Frank case has been taken in incredible directions, and so many lies have been told by what people think of as responsible media outlets. And all of these things are believed by so many who then say that my gosh, Frank did not get a fair trial, and therefore he should be pardoned. He was possibly innocent. We don't know because he didn't get a fair trial. That is simply false. And finally, forged time slips against Newt Lee, forged bloody shirt against Lee, forged affidavits against the girls, forged letter of the dead Judge Roan, forged letters of a couple of Negroes. Well, the whole case of the defense is like this, and it reeked with fraud, bribery, perjury, and forgery. Now I would like to compare the case of Leo Frank with two other cases of Jews being accused of serious crimes and being let off because of international effort organized on their behalf. Organized by whom? Well, by their Jewish brethren, of course. If Leo Frank had not been lynched by those respectable and responsible men of Cobb County, Georgia, he would have eventually been set free by the huge national effort on his behalf. The people of Georgia were stronger than most people elsewhere in standing up for their truth and the rightness of their way of life, and in resisting the Jewish pressure against them, which was enormous. Thomas Watson has described some of it in his magazine articles, which are really gems. Audiobooks have been made of them, read by Vanessa Neubauer, who does a great job. They are a pleasure to listen to, and I recommend them highly. It's even better, though, to read them for yourself. They are available at www.leofrank.org and also at www.nationalvanguard.org. Watson quotes some of the outrageous things that were said in northern and southern newspapers, and of course are still being said today. I want to myself quote from one of Tom Watson's issues about these other crime cases involving Jews that got international attention. I quote, "Have the children of Moses the right to break the Sinai tables?" He's speaking of the Ten Commandments. "Do they deserve death when they slay Hebrews only? Is there some unwritten law which absolves them when their victim is a Gentile? They are taught in their Talmud that as a man is superior to other animals, so are the Jews superior to all other men. Do the Hebrews of today hold to that in their heart of hearts? They are taught by their great teacher, Rabbana Ashi, that those who are not Jews are dogs and asses. Are the Hebrews true to Talmud and to their learned Rabbana? Was Mary Fagan, the Irish girl, legitimate spoil for the descendant of those who divided among themselves the daughters of the Midianite? Is there a secret tenet of their religion which compels the entire race to combine to save the neck of such a loathsome degenerate as Leo Frank? They did not waste a dollar, nor a day, on the Jews who were electrocuted for shooting Rosenthal. Was it because Rosenthal was a Jew? If the victim in that case had been an Irishman, would there have been a Haas Finance Committee, a nationwide distribution of lying circulars, a flying column of mendacious detectives, a constantly increasing supply of political lawyers, the muzzling of daily papers, an attempt to enlist the northern school children, peace societies, and anti-capital punishment leagues? Money talks, and in this Frank case, money talked as loudly and as resourcefully as though Baron Hirsch's $45 million Hebrew fund had been copiously poured into the campaign. I need to interject a comment here. These words of Watson's brought up these thoughts in me. We all know the answers to these questions that he's asking, but complaining and griping about the Jewish power is not enough. In fact, it helps the Jews because they use it to bolster their charges of anti-Semitism. It is this very concept of anti-Semitism that has to be done away with, not apologized for or evaded or say, oh, I'm not that. The Jews must be deprived of it. Dislike of Jewish criminality is not a sin. It's not an insanity. It's not a mistake or error, not a cruelty, not hate. Aversion of Jews is natural, normal, healthy for white Europeans because of the history of the damage that Jews have done in our nations. We must not apologize for wanting a Jew-free society, but this is why anti-racism was established. So continuing on, quoting from Tom Watson's writing, "It is a peculiar and portentous thing that one race of men, and one only, should be able to convulse the world by a system of newspaper agitation and suppression when a member of that race is convicted of a capital crime against another race. Does anybody in this country know what was the truth about Dreyfus, the French officer who was convicted of treason and at first sentenced to death? Just for your information, Dreyfus was arrested in 1894 and pardoned in 1899, so he's pretty closely contemporary with Frank." Watson goes on, asking the question, does anybody know the truth about Dreyfus? He says, "Nobody does. All we know is what the newspapers told us, and it leaked out afterwards that the wife of Dreyfus abandoned him as soon as he was turned loose. Presumably, she was a Jewess, but like the other Hebrew champions of Dreyfus, she dropped him as soon as she had accomplished her purpose. One of the Rothschild banking houses exerts a powerful influence over French finances. Another in Frankfurt, another in Vienna, and another in London have often stood together to control the policies of European governments. If they insisted upon the liberation of Dreyfus, the French Republic, beset by royalists, socialists, and clericals, was in no condition to resist the demand. The peculiar thing and the sinister thing is that some secret organization existed which could permeate the whole European world, and the United States also, with the literature which clamored for Dreyfus. The father of Dreyfus was an Alsatian banker, a Jew, of course, and a subject of the Kaiser. He was a cog in the wheel of the German spy system, and he used his son, the French officer, to secure for the Berlin government the military secrets of the French War Office. France had not then formed her defensive alliance with Great Britain and was not strong enough to fully expose Dreyfus and the Kaiser, which could thus precipitate a war. The French officer, Ricard, who was the staunch champion of Dreyfus in every one of the investigations, turned against the Jew after he himself was given a position in the War Office and learned the truth from indubitable documentary evidence. Certainly he's saying that Dreyfus was guilty of being a spy. And as a matter of fact, as the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, was formed at the time right after the Frank trial concluded, the Human Rights League of France was founded on 4th June 1898 by the Republican Ludovic Thériault to defend Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a Jew wrongly convicted for treason, wrongly convicted in their eyes. This would be known as the Dreyfus Affair. This organization was dissolved during World War II, that is, by the National Socialists when they occupied France, but it was clandestinely reconstituted in 1943 by a central committee and reestablished after the liberation. I did a program on the Dreyfus Affair with Margaret Huffstickler on January 19th of this year. You can find it by searching Dreyfus Affair, Heretics Hour, on the CarolynJaeger.net website. Now Watson goes on to say, the Bylus case in Russia was equally remarkable in its progress and its end. A Gentile boy was found dead with more than 40 small incisions in his veins and arteries, from which practically every drop of his blood had been drawn, and the blood had left no marks anywhere. That much trickled through the newspapers to the American people, and they realized, of course, that here was a novelty in deliberate and atrocious crime. Bylus, a Russian Jew, was accused of kidnapping the little boy and emptying his blood vessels of their contents in order that it might be used in a religious sacrifice. The Russian court found Bylus guilty, but apparently the same mighty engine of agitation and suppression that had worked for Dreyfus was put in motion for Bilas. Mankind was told that there was no such thing as blood sacrifice among Russian Jews, and that Bilas was the victim of jungle fury, race hatred, lynch law, etc., etc. In the meanwhile, the hysterical public lost sight of the pallid corpse of the Gentile boy, whose veins presented the pale lips of 45 cuts made by a sharp instrument. Somebody had killed the lad, most deliberately, most cruelly, and the Russian courts, in full possession of the facts, declared that Bilas had done it. But the American people, not knowing the facts and totally in the dark as to who did get the blood out of the boy's veins, were excitedly certain that Bilas didn't. Consequently, a pressure of the same peculiar and irresistible sort that had saved Dreyfus caused Russia to stay her uplifted hand and spare Bilas. To this day, the Americans who blindly, hysterically, helped to put the pressure on the Tsar's government have no idea who made the 45 slits in the blood vessels of the little boy, and what's more, they don't care. They accomplished their emotional purpose, blew off their psychological steam, and then forgot all about Bilas and the boy. This is the end of my quoting from Thomas Watson. Likewise, Americans do not know or care who killed Mary Fagan. They just know that Leo Frank did not. Amazing, yes? Menachem Bendel Bilas was a Russian Jew of the Hasid sect. He was said to be an average working man, and yet, in his trial, he was represented by the most able consuls of the Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Kiev bars, Vasily Malakhov, Oskar Grutzenberg, N. Karabchevsky, A. Zarudny, and D. Grigorovich Barsky, all represented him. Two prominent Russian professors, Troitsky and Kokotsov, spoke on behalf of the defense in praise of Jewish values and exposed the falsehood of the accusations, while professor of Kiev Theological Seminary, Orthodox Christian philosopher Alexander Glagolev, affirmed that, quote, the law of Moses forbids spilling human blood and using any blood in general in food, unquote. But you see, this has nothing to do with what individual Jews would do. Bilas is today called a victim of anti-Semitism, just the same as Alfred Dreyfus and Leo Frank. Bilas became a cause celebre in America, yet it was proven that the blood-taking which led to the death of the boy was carried out in Bilas' own brick factory. He was a superintendent of that factory, just as Frank was a superintendent of his pencil factory. Quite a coincidence. But how could that be if he was not involved? How could the murder have taken place, which took over a period of more than one day to complete the whole process? How could that have taken place in his brick factory and him not be involved in it at all? What is written about on Wikipedia is a twisted up lie, mainly by omitting anything that is not favorable to Bilas. And that's what they do in all of these cases, I realize. What they do on Wikipedia mainly is to get rid of anything that is not favorable to their point of view. And here is one more thing about Bilas. In the March 2006 issue of the Ukrainian Personnel Plus magazine by the Interregional Academy of Personnel Management, there appeared an article, Murder is Unveiled, the Murderer is Unknown, which revives accusations from the Bilas trial, stating that the jury recognized the case as ritual murder by persons unknown, even though it found Bilas himself not guilty. So this was clearly a case of ritual murder. Nobody can really deny that, although they did and they do. But the fact is that Bilas was superintendent of the brick factory where the ritual murder took place, and therefore he was charged with the murder. But they couldn't actually prove it on him. Bilas, as superintendent, had to be aware of everything that was going on, certainly something like that. Just as Leo Frank, as superintendent of the pencil factory, was aware of what went on in that factory, and nobody could carry things out that he didn't know about. it was not anti-Semitism or some kind of hatred of Jews that caused them to arrest this Menachem Mendel Bilas. There was perfectly good reason for it. But unfortunately, there was such an uproar against it because whenever it is ritual murder, then the Jews go into overdrive to deny and bring that down. So here we have three cases, Dreyfus, Bilas, and Frank, around the same time, of guilty Jews being the recipients of big money campaigns to find them innocent. In all three, the victim is forgotten in the cry and hue of the Jewish victim, who is victimized by Gentiles for being a Jew. This becomes the crime. The crime is against the Jew. The actual crime fades into the background and disappears. This is the exact method used by Jews to get out of trouble in the Gentile world in which they've lived for centuries. It's a fixed equation. Yet we still don't seem to know how it works. Our people fall for it time and time again. That's why the Leo Frank case is such a teachable vehicle for us. It contains so many great lessons, and it aligns with so many others. We have to remind ourselves that Jews are not good people. They may be good to each other, and I think they are good to each other, but they are not good to us. Leo Frank was doing his best to have any one of several non-Jews take the blame for what he knew was his own crime. Alfred Dreyfus did the same. So today, 100 years after the Frank lynching, we are being flooded with Jewish-sponsored news stories about Frank's innocence and that the state of Georgia still hasn't done enough to right that terrible wrong that occurred there. As always, Jewry is not satisfied except with total victory. I'd like to end this program with some statements from Frank's lawyers that reveal that it was they who brought up the Jewish question in the original trial, not the people of Georgia. It is in the Jews' interest to make it appear, always, as if anti-Semitism is at work. In fact, this is their modus operandi, their very best ammunition, so they always use it. Here are some excerpts from Reuben Arnold's closing argument. Reuben Arnold was Frank's number two lawyer, you might say, but almost on an equal basis with Luther Rosser, and he gave the major closing argument. Close to the beginning, he said, "I'll tell you right now, if Frank hadn't been a Jew, there would never have been any prosecution against him. I'm asking my own people to turn him loose, asking them to do justice to a Jew, and I'm not a Jew, but I would rather die before doing injustice to a Jew." Wow. He is saying a Christian has to be extra careful of Jews, more so than of other Christians. That's his personal belief. That Frank was prosecuted for this crime only because he was a Jew. That there was no evidence against him, which is patently false. But then he also says that as a Christian, he would rather die than do an injustice to a Jew. And he wants to do justice to this Jew, more so than he cares about doing justice to non-Jews, clearly. A little further on, he says, "This crime is the hideous act of a Negro who would ravish a 10-year-old girl the same as he would ravish a woman of years. It isn't a white man's crime. It's the crime of a beast, a low, savage beast." Yet I have to interject that Conley had never gotten in trouble because of anything to do with white people. All of the misdemeanors that he had on his record had to do with arguments and fights with other Negroes. Arnold goes on. "He said that he heard Frank and Mary Fagan walking upstairs, and that he heard Mary Fagan scream, and that immediately after hearing the scream, he let Montine Stover into the building. The man that wrote those murder notes is the man who killed that girl. Prove that man was there and that he wrote the notes, and you know who killed the girl." Conley acknowledges that he wrote the notes, and witnesses have proved that he was there, and he admits that too. "That Negro was in the building near the elevator shaft. It took but two steps for him to grab that little girl's mesh bag. She probably held on to it and struggled with him. A moment later, he had struck her in the eye, and she had fallen. It is the work of a moment for Conley to throw her down the elevator shaft. Well, I have to say, and I know girls and women and what they would do if their purse is being snatched, that little Mary Fagan would have cried out if this Negro had grabbed her purse with her pay in it that she needed very much. She would have cried out and yelled, and she probably would have called help. That's the word that usually comes to mind first. Help! Because she knew she needed help. And Leo Frank, if he was the man he says he was, sitting up in his office just up the stairs, would have heard, and he would have come to see what was going on. So that doesn't show that this attorney who has been paid so much money is making a convincing statement here. But he's doing it because it's all he has, and also what he says can be repeated all over the country in all these newspapers without the other part, without what I've pointed out being said. And then this helps to create this belief in the defense's arguments. Then Arnold says, "Now, I don't believe the little Stover girl ever went into the inner office. She was a sweet, innocent, timid little girl, and she just peeped into the office from the outer one, and if Frank was in there, the safe door hid him from her view, or if he was not there, he might have stepped out for just a moment." So here he's making up a story that he's just totally invented himself about what could have happened, and that she was afraid to go in the office, and so she didn't see that he was in there. Or if that's not true, then he might have just stepped out for a moment. Well, I saw a picture of this Montine Stover. She was supposedly about 14 years old, and she looked real confident, and she didn't look at all the picture of a timid little girl. Not at all. Arnold went on to say, "If Frank had killed her, he would have just slipped her pay envelope back in the safe and declared that he never saw her that day at all, and then no one could have ever explained how she got into that basement." Well, there he's wrong too, because he's not following the evidence here. He's making things up. Mary Fagan told people that she was going to go to the factory and get her pay on Saturday before she went to see the parade. She told this to her mother, and she told this to that boy that she met, a friend of hers, that she met on the trolley car, and they got off at the same stop, and she told him where she was going. It would have been figured out clearly that that's where she went, and that's where she never came out of. That's where she stayed. So Arnold goes on, but Frank couldn't know that there was hatred enough in this country against his race to bring such a hideous charge against him. Boy, now there's something far out. Enough hatred left in this country? Left from when? When was there more hatred against Jews than there would have been at that time? There wasn't hatred against Jews in this country. In fact, there might have been more resentment toward Jews after 1900 when Jews started arriving en masse. But to say there was hatred enough left in this country is saying that there was used to be a lot of hatred and some of it was still left. And this was hatred against Jews. So he's also saying that the witnesses who simply testified what they knew to be the truth about Leo Frank was based on hatred. He may have been speaking about just a few of the witnesses that I haven't even discussed here, and I'm not planning to do so. But if he's only talking about two witnesses, then he shouldn't be saying something like that. So there again, he's not basing his closing arguments on facts. Arnold also said, "This case has been made up of just two things, prejudice and perjury. I've never seen such malice, such personal hatred in all my life, and I don't think anyone ever has." And then finally, this is his very closing words, "But above all, gentlemen, let's follow the law in this matter. In circumstantial cases, you can't convict a man as long as there's any other possible theory for the crime of which he is accused, and you can't find Frank guilty if there's a chance that Conley is the murderer. The state has nothing on which to base their case but Conley, and we've shown Conley a liar. Write your verdict of not guilty, and your consciences will give you approval." Well, of course, saying that the state has nothing on which to base their case but Conley is a total falsehood. And this has been the falsehood that's been put forth at that time and ever since. And a lot of people believe it, but it's not true. And you have to really study the evidence yourself to see how much of it there is and how the evidence convicts Frank. And now just a few words about Frank's lead attorney, Luther Z. Rosser, who gave a rather short closing argument. It was totally based on an effort to create doubt in the minds of the jurors about the evidence. But many months further along in the investigation, it was live leaked that Luther Z. Rosser was retained for a handsome, unheard-of sum of $12,500 to $15,000. To put things into context, $12,500 to $15,000 was enough money back in the 1910s to buy an absolutely fabulous estate outside of Greater Atlanta. 1913 was the year the Federal Reserve was born, and American money has depleted 100% or 99%, something like that, since then. So the sum that Rosser received, just as a retainer maybe, to take the case, was $1.5 million today. That's pretty amazing. If Luther's $12,500 seems exorbitant, Reuben Arnold later joined the Leo Frank defense dream team for an equally whopping $10,000. Before the trial even started, at least $22,500, which would equal around $2.25 million today, had been released to the two top-of-the-top lawyers in the state of Georgia. Not to mention, they were the leaders, part of an expensive dream team totaling 8 lawyers for the Leo M. Frank defense. Could it be that Leo Frank himself was worth having that much money spent on him? No, but he was a Jew. And he was president of the Atlanta B'nai B'rith. The fund on behalf of Leo Frank was to the tune of 6 figures, that's in 1913 dollars, and hemorrhaging New York Jewish media mogul greenbacks to the likes of Jewish advertising magnate Albert Davis Lasker and New York Times owner Adolph Simon Oakes. What that's saying is that lots of money that was raised from Jews for the most part, but other people put it money in too, because they had people standing on street corners and in traffic collecting money for Leo Frank's defense all over the country, in Chicago, in New York, in other big cities. This was going on, and a lot of people were giving small amounts, which added up, naturally. But all this money, a whole lot of this money was going to Jews Lasker and Oakes for the work that they were doing on behalf of the Frank defense. Most observers felt that because Leo Frank had the best legal team money could buy, the fact he was convicted unanimously by the 13-man panel of the presiding judge Leonard Roan and jury of 12, followed by 2 years of court reviews rendering majority decisions he had a fair trial, meant he was likely guilty. This is especially true in light of the 1986 decision where Leo Frank received a highly political pardon without disturbing the verdict of the jury and without exonerating him of the crime of which he was convicted. But the Jews would have you believe otherwise, that Frank was innocent but was convicted because of the anti-Semitism of the people of Georgia. Well, by the time August 1915 rolled around, quite a few Atlantans could very well have been feeling anti-Semitic due to all the attacks on their characters by Jews from all around the nation. There was very little positive feeling coming to Georgia from the rest of the world, and those in Georgia knew who was responsible. Thomas Watson let them know. It was the most prominent man in Cobb County where Marietta was situated who organized themselves in what they called the Knights of Mary Fagan and openly planned to kidnap Frank from the state prison farm where he had a cushy private room. The last letter he wrote to his wife was downright cheerful. He was certainly expecting the big money northern Jews and their legal brains to continue working on his behalf. The Knights of Mary Fagan were 28 men who, apart from the leaders, were selected for their various skills. An electrician, an automobile mechanic, a locksmith, a medic, a preacher, a telephone man, and of course, a hangman. They didn't wear masks, but their names were known only locally until the year 2000, when a librarian posted on the internet a list compiled by Mary Fagan Keene, little Mary Fagan's great niece. These men deserve our praise. As I've already said, but I want to say it again, because it is my position on Leo Frank's lynching. If they hadn't done what they did, Leo Frank would have eventually been released from prison, just as Dreyfus was, and as Bylus was, and even as the despicable Jewish spy Jonathan Pollard is soon to be released. If only we had men who could get hold of Pollard and do to him what those men did to Leo Frank. They had it well planned, and they carried it out almost to perfection. The entire Atlanta and surrounding community were mostly behind their action because of what Governor Slayton had done. Certainly, we wish we had men like that today, but in today's world, they would never get away with it. More's the pity. Lastly, I want to give you a rundown of the commemorative events that took place today and before and after, which I found on the American Jewish Committee website. First, they describe Frank's trial with the usual lies, which is what you're going to hear at all the events, too. They write, quote, "Convicted on circumstantial evidence following a shoddy investigation amid a sea of anti-Semitic rhetoric, Frank was sentenced to die. Governor John Slayton commuted his sentence after thoroughly reviewing the case, so enraging some Georgians that the governor was hanged in effigy and had to declare martial law for a time." Unquote. Again, they say that it took place in a sea of anti-Semitic rhetoric, when the only anti-Semitic rhetoric came from Frank's own lawyers and from all of the newspapers all around the country, the Jewish newspapers that were putting out that kind of rhetoric. It did not come from the prosecution of the case or from the trial, except for the defense lawyers. It's just amazing how they do this. The first event that opened today is called Seeking Justice, the Leo Frank Case Revisited. It's an exhibition of original artifacts and photography. At the Southern Museum of Civil War and Locomotive History, and it's been put together in partnership with the William Bremen Jewish Heritage Museum and the Museum of History and Holocaust Education. Naturally, the Holocaust gets in there, and in Atlanta, they have a Museum of Holocaust Education. I'd like to say that because 100,000 Jews are now in Atlanta, there are all kinds of Jewish museums, as many or more, no doubt, than for all of the white Georgians, because every time I turn around, there's a Jewish museum that's involved in this affair. And the same group that is hosting the Seeking Justice is hosting a commemorative event at 2 p.m. today at Congregation Ner Tamid, so that is a synagogue. And the scheduled speakers include Rabbi Tom Liebschutz, former Georgia Governor Roy Barnes, Christine Goldstein, and Dr. Catherine Lewis. Now, Roy Barnes is one of those cowardly, let's all get along types. Oakland Cemetery is remembering Leo Frank by hosting two tours, which they did yesterday, August 16th, the titled Fear and Accusation, the Leo Frank Story. And it is followed by the Jewish grounds of Oakland, so it must be a Jewish or partly Jewish cemetery. The admission for this is $20 for both tours for adults and $12 for one tour. Then yesterday there was a Leo Frank memorial service at Temple Kol Emeth in Marietta. That is Rabbi Libo's synagogue. And here, among those expected to attend are Otis Brumby III, the publisher of the Marietta Daily Journal, and Allison Barnes Salter, principal of the Barnes Law Group, both descended from men involved in the lynching. Oh, wow. These descendants of the original 28 are going to listen to Frank described as an innocent man. Their ancestors wouldn't do that. But it's because of the spirit of tolerance that Jews promote, which goes along with their abiding interest in anti-Semitism, that we have fallen this far in the past 100 years. In describing his service yesterday, Rabbi LeBeau said, "All we are trying to do with the service that day and in weeks and months to come is to clear an innocent man's name. No more, but no less will do." See, that's his intention. And he gets so much newsprint, this man, because everybody goes to him because he's the one that's being the most active. He says he knows children and grandchildren of members of the lynching party and said almost all of them are, quote, the nicest, sweetest, not racist or anti-Semitic group of people, unquote. Rabbi LeBeau would like the Board of Pardons and Paroles to issue a pardon that will acknowledge one simple fact, just four words long. Leo Frank was innocent. Failing that, he would welcome a proclamation from the governor or from the Cobb County Board of Commissioners or from the Marietta City Council. Now, here's the thing. Neither the governor nor the Board of Commissioners nor the City Council can issue statements that Leo Frank was innocent when the court records say otherwise. Has to come from the Board of Pardons, and the Board of Pardons cannot do that because it doesn't have anything to base it on. So you have to ask, what is this LeBeau doing besides being an idiot? He's building up propaganda and talking points and things that can be put out in articles and newspapers and preached here and there, talking about how we still should be declaring Leo Frank innocent. He links to the Cobb County Board of Commissioners and to the Marietta City Council because he's encouraging his readers and listeners and so on to write there and tell them that they want them to make some statement of pardon for Leo Frank. So I went there and I left a message on each one. So you should, too. I'm going to put the links on the program post, and I do encourage you to send email messages telling them that you think that Leo Frank was guilty and that Georgia should not do another thing in that arena. Let everything stay as it is. And now listen to this. Rabbi Shalom Lewis, who is an associate of LeBeau, he acknowledged his own learning curve about the Leo Frank case. He said, quote, "I do not recall when I first became aware of the Frank case. I suspect that I stumbled across it in my study of modern American history, unlikely, or a reference in a documentary on anti-Semitism, well, that's very likely, but not until I moved to Marietta and saw the TV movie with Jack Lemmon did I really understand what happened here and the panic and migration north of many within the Jewish community." That's so good because that is probably exactly where most people, including most Jews, get their information about the Leo Frank case, from something like the TV movie with Jack Lemmon. And then there was a tree planting commemorative program at 2 p.m. yesterday, Sunday, at the congregation Etz Chaim in Marietta. So on that occasion, I guess they planted a tree for Leo. Tomorrow, on August 18th, you can go to An Evening with History, From the Dark Side, the Leo Frank Case, which will be a lecture by former Marietta City Councilman Van Perlberg, who I've mentioned earlier in the program. This is at the Marietta Museum of History. Admission is $10 for members and $20 for non-members. Naturally, the same story will be told. But still, you see how active they are? How tireless they are? Not so with us. And finally, at the Museum of History and Holocaust Education in the Kennesaw State University Center, there is a program, but it won't be until September 21st, titled Leo Frank, 100 Years in the Media. Actually, that sounds more interesting than any of the others. They probably have a Holocaust exhibit up right now, and they can't change it until September 21st. But this could be considered the year of Leo Frank and the Leo Frank case. So spreading it out like that is no doubt a very smart idea. Well, 100-year anniversaries don't come around very often, so one needs to make the most of it. I leave you with a question. How will the Leo Frank murder case look 100 years from now on its 200-year anniversary? Will there even be such a thing? You and I won't be around then, but what we do now will make a difference in what it will be like then. Thanks for listening. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on Monday, August 17th, 2015. So long for now.